Hello, Cameron, and welcome to our Cybersecurity and Insurance Leaders Show. Really excited to have you on. One of our inaugural guests. Let me just kind of open up the floor. What could you tell me about yourself and your company and your team?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you very much, Anthony, for having me as a guest. When you reached out to me initially, I honestly thought it was a mistake, and that's why I immediately responded so quickly. Hey, yeah, absolutely, I'll be on this program with you. So I'm really honored to be one of your inaugural guests. I'm really excited to talk with you about all things cyber, and so super happy to be here. So I am a incident response attorney, for lack of a better term. I think on LinkedIn I'm a data privacy and cybersecurity attorney, but candidly, I love incident response work, and that's really where my focus is. And so I am at Troutman Pepper, where I am one of the leaders of our incident response team. And so my task at Troutman Pepper is to grow the incident response group. And as you know, the way to grow that group is to talk with insurance carriers, make good arrangements and relationships with insurance carriers, and use that as a way to sort of channel and funnel in all of the incident response work. And so that's what I'm doing now at Troutman Pepper. Before that, I was at a couple of the big name incident response firms and had great leadership and mentorship, or people leading me and mentoring me at those firms. And I learned a lot from all of those individuals. And so, but for them, I would not be in this position that I am today at Troutman Pepper. So I'm very grateful to all of those that have helped me along the way to get here.
That's great. That's great. Thanks for the fantastic intro. It really is a pleasure to have you. So what could you tell me maybe in terms of geographies that you're focused on? Assume it's primarily US, but maybe can you tell me a bit more?
Yeah, we're absolutely, we're focused right now on the US, across all 50 states, and I think there's four territories. That's really our primary focus, and that's really for two reasons. One, most of the insurance companies, of course, not all, focus on the U.S. Side of things, or at least are divided with, U.S. and international. But, our skill set is mostly focused on U.S. privacy law, U.S. cybersecurity law. That said, we will, often come across legal issues affecting, the GDPR, maybe sometimes Brazil, Canada. We have some experience in those areas, but certainly nothing that we would sort of hold ourselves out to be experts in those areas. So we do deal with some issues relating there and certainly can handle those types of issues. But our prime focus right now is the United States.
Okay. Oh, thanks for that. So just in terms of clients then, is it all over the map, or what kind of clients do you think you're really focused on?
So for now, because we are sort of new, as Troutman Pepper is new in the insurance incident response umbrella, our focus now is really anything, right? In terms of, we will happily work with small companies, middle-sized companies, large companies. I think ultimately what will happen in a perfect world is we'll be able to hone in on a subset of those and sort of specialize in, hey, we are, the go-to firm for, this type of company and this location. I think that's, in perfect world, a few years off, and maybe something that will never come to fruition. So I think for now it's across the board, and I think that helps. I think it helps give you a wide range of skill sets and experiences, which, so then once you finally are able to sort of find your niche, then you have a lot more experience that you can use to help you in that area.
Okay, so it's interesting. You mentioned having, a newer team and being quite open to a lot of different things, but I think you guys are probably pretty experienced. What kind of things would you consider to be your strengths from, maybe things you've been doing so far?
So certainly, I think we have, although we are a new team in sort of the insurance incident response world, the team that we have is very experienced, and we have a lot of experience across, the three sort of pillars of privacy, cybersecurity, and pillar one being compliance, pillar two being the incident response process, and pillar three being the litigation / regulation follow-up, right? And so we have a team that's a mix of people that are very skilled in privacy compliance, whether it's GDPR, whether it's CCPA, whether it's those new privacy statutes coming out like in Utah, Virginia, Colorado, so to help focus and create an environment that has security controls in place. Then we also have a team such as, myself and Sadia, who's on my team. We have tons of experience doing incident response work. I've probably handled, you know, hundreds, if not maybe 1,000 matters in my time on the incident response side. And so that is sort of, all right, we have the privacy, the compliance side, which says, let's try to come up with a scenario where we're going to limit the possibility of having an incident. We have a great team of people that are skilled there. We have a team of people that are skilled in the incident response side, which is, all right, now something has happened. Let's figure out how to resolve it in a manner that is going to minimize any impact on both the client as well as the client's, you know, customers and vendors and things of that nature. And then the third component, the litigation regulatory side, sometimes notwithstanding everything you do, regulatory follow-up happens. Sometimes there's class action suits. And so we have an exceptional team there that is focused on those aspects. And I think, you know, the Troutman Pepper team in the last 5 years has really been focused on that litigation regulation side. And so I'm trying to add some more focus on that incident response side.
Okay. So kind of shifting from being a very litigation focused practice to extending into what you do with more incident response.
Absolutely. One of the reasons why I came over to Troutman was I felt that the other firms that I was working at, there's, you know, a tremendous focus on incident response, which obviously is fantastic. And those firms are fantastic in the space. But one of the things that I wanted to try to do was to broaden that focus just a little bit, to focus a little bit more on the compliance or the front end and on the back end on the regulatory side. But also to integrate those other components into the incident response world, because I think if you have sort of that before incident approach and post incident approach, if you can bring those aspects to the actual incident itself, I think that helps not only how you handle that incident, but it also helps some of those insureds are going to have those post incident conversations with regulators. And so if they are familiar with the people that helped them through the incident and those same people are able to help them after the incident, I think that helps the carriers. I think it also helps the insured. And I think that's something that I know in my conversations with carriers recently, that's something they've been focused on. And so I'm hopeful that we can bring a little bit of a nuanced approach to that process. That's one of the things that we're trying to focus on here.
Okay, thanks. So I guess shifting gears a bit into, you know, some of your thoughts on different elements of things that happen in the cyber world, as I call it, which is, you know, for what we do, it could be anything. It could be cyber insurance, sort of cyber breach legal stuff, or cyber technical. So, you know, any of the things I tend to talk about could be in any of those areas. I thought I'd ask you, you know, what is a commonly held belief that you've seen out there kind of in this cyber world that you passionately disagree with? So it's a belief a lot of people might have, but you really disagree with it.
So I think there's going to be two. And the first one is the notion of, and this is a little bit more minor, but I'll explain why I think it's important. The first is the notion that the company that has suffered, let's say, the ransomware attack is specifically targeted by the threat actors. And the reason why that's a misconception that I'm sort of adamantly against is because I think what some companies will do is say, hey, we're a small, you know, medical office. The threat actors are not having, they don't have any interest in us. We don't have any, you know, we're not a big company. We're not going to generate a lot of news. Therefore, we don't need to worry about being attacked. And so I think that belief that you're not a target, kind of you put your barriers or your sort of radar down and say, oh, this isn't going to concern us. So I'm not going to focus on cybersecurity type of issues. And so that's why I'm against that, because I think it's just the opposite, right? A company that doesn't focus on cybersecurity principles, those are the ones that are attacked most often, because the threat actors are always going for sort of the low-hanging fruit, the open vulnerabilities, and attacking those. So that would be the first one that I would love to sort of message that out. And I get lots of times questions, why did they pick us, right? You know, we're just a small company. Why would they attack us? And I have to explain that it's not about you. It's about your security posture. The second thing that sort of comes up a lot, which I'm very much against, is the we don't negotiate with terrorists aspect of of the negotiation process when it comes to a ransomware attack. And the reason why I'm against that is because it cuts off a lot of your options as an individual, or excuse me, as a company responding to a ransomware attack. So my job in these incident responses is really to guide the company and provide them with the most options available. And so from based on those options, we can make the most, you know, business best, you know, the decisions that are best for the business based on those options. And so we always want to minimize legal liability, but we also want to minimize business disruption. We want to minimize disruption to customers, clients, all of that stuff. So it's not just a very cut and dry type of approach. There's lots of different decision points, and the best way to make decisions is those decisions are informed. And so if you take the blanket position of we don't negotiate with terrorists, now you've cut off a lot of information, right? You don't know what information the threat actor took from your environment, if any. You don't know if the threat actor is actually bluffing, right? A lot of times a threat actor will say, we have your info. And then you ask, well, prove to us that you have some information. And they don't do that. So you don't even know if they have your information. And if they do have your information, you don't know what they have. You don't know where, if they've shared that information, if they've posted that information. So you're really depriving yourself of a lot of decision points, right? And so now you're operating in a vacuum of, well, I don't know what they took. I don't know, you know, where it is. And now you have to have a conversation with clients after the fact, if you're reporting a ransomware incident and customers, and they're going to ask you, well, what information of ours did the threat actor take? And your answer is, I don't know, right? You know, how much of it did they take? I don't know. And so then you look from a company standpoint, you look like you didn't conduct a very thorough investigation. You don't have answers to your customers or clients that are satisfactory. They're going to think that you're sort of ill-qualified to handle their data because you've had an attack, one, and two, you don't even know sort of what was taken. So what's the point of this whole process? So I think that hurts you both on the legal side, in terms of, you know, maybe sometimes you can avoid notification based on your communications with the threat actor, but I think it hurts you more on your decision-making process, as well as in your relationships with your customers and your clients. And I think that's an area that I think is often overlooked in the incident response process, that it's really about, you know, there's always a legal focus, and rightfully so, but I think there's also a business focus that should be there, where we have to apply a practical aspect to this and do what's best from a business standpoint to things. And I think you need to know what the threat actor did when you have an attack like that.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, you know, that people really cut off some of these avenues where, you know, they end up causing a lot of damage in a lot of different ways through early decisions, or, you know, really dogmatic decisions, perhaps.
Absolutely. I think, and I understand that sort of approach, right? You don't want the threat actors to profit off of ill, you know, ill-gotten gains and those types of things. But, you know, just because you're talking to the threat actor doesn't mean you're going to pay the threat actor a ransom. And so there's a lot of sort of, you know, just unfamiliarity with the process, and rightfully so. This process isn't one that should be well known, really, unless you're in it. You should really, hopefully you're never in it. But if you are in it, that's part of our job, is to sort of guide you through and tell you how it's going to work. And these are the types of things that you should do so you can get the most amount of information. And from that, you can make the best decisions for the company.
So let me take that question and flip it around. What is something you think everyone is perhaps doing today that they should stop doing?
Sure. And that's an interesting question, because it's sort of goes a little bit counter to what I was just talking about, which was the focus should always be on the company and putting the company in the best position, right? And so obviously the company many times has that same mentality, right? And so a lot of times when we have an incident, we won't find out about it until maybe 72 hours after the fact. And in that 72 hours, the IT has already gone ahead, cleaned all the machines, gotten the company sort of back up and running. And I totally understand from the IT side, and the CEO, and hey, we want to keep the production line going. And so I absolutely understand that mindset. It's with a good intentions to keep the business operating. Unfortunately, what that does is it destroys any available forensic evidence, and that creates a host of problems, right? One, you're not going to have an ability to conduct a legitimate or thorough forensic investigation. And oftentimes in a forensic investigation, you can determine how the threat actor got in. Not always, but often you can. And so if you don't know how the threat actor got in, the chances of the threat actor getting in again is increased, because you haven't closed any avenue for the threat actor to get in. So by jumping the gun and getting, you know, back operational too soon can then create a vulnerability for you 3 months down the road, because that vulnerability that was there initially that led to the attack could still be there, and you could be attacked again. But then also, Secondarily, when we're talking about our customers, our vendors, our employees, again, we're not going to really know how the threat actor got in, what information they took necessarily, because all that forensic evidence is destroyed. And so we're not going to have those answers. And so from a goodwill standpoint, we've sort of hurt ourselves because we can't have a message to our customers and our vendors and our employees saying, hey, we had an attack. We conducted a thorough forensic investigation. Based on that forensic investigation, our environment is clean. We know what data was taken or no data was taken. We've taken these appropriate steps. So that would be, if an incident occurs and you want to get back up and running, fine, but preserve a forensic copy of the impacted systems before you do so.
Yeah, it is, and I've experienced a lot of that myself in the past. It is really scary when someone's come in and deleted or restored over data, because again, you're not getting it back at that point. Right. Especially in really sensitive data, really regulated industries like healthcare, things like that, can be pretty scary, I think, when you come in too late on something like that.
Absolutely. And then for the, for both the insurance side and the legal side, you're sort of operating, uphill, because you're deprived of a lot of that initial information. And usually in a ransomware attack, those first, 48, 72 hours are very critical, a lot with decision-making and making sure the environment is clean. And so you're going to be deprived of a lot of that information. And really what it sets you up potentially is to be sort of back in the pre-incident status, 3 months down the road, and that's just makes you ripe for a re-attack, which is the last thing that you want to have happen.
Yeah. So. Yeah, definitely. Okay, so just what are maybe something that people are not doing that they should be doing in cyber?
I think two things. One is thinking, and I think this has happened. This is less and less of a concern of mine, but I think still some people think that, it's not going to happen to us. We're a small group. So we don't need to really focus a lot on cybersecurity. I think another aspect of that. So I'll say three things. I know I lied and said two things, so number one is it's not going to happen to us. Number two is putting too much trust in your sort of IT or your third party, provider in terms of, hey, we outsource all of our security stuff and therefore it's perfectly fine, right? There's no oversight. And I can't tell you how many times I've been on a call with third party IT and I'm more qualified than third party IT. And if I'm more qualified than your third party IT in terms of security measures, you got a big problem, right? And so that should never be the case, but it happens more often than not. Yeah. Where you're putting too much trust. And so I think, in a best case scenario, people are going to focus on cybersecurity. But if they're going to outsource that, they need to have some sort of oversight and ability to make sure that what they're outsourcing is actually being taken care of. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing I would say is get cyber insurance, right? Because not only is cyber insurance going to help defray some of the costs in terms of the incident response process, but I think one of the most important things and often overlooked things about cyber insurance is it puts you in touch with the appropriate people in the industry. And so oftentimes, again, if you don't have cyber insurance and you have an attack, you might just go to your IT. And if this IT is the one that is sort of responsible for the attack, and I say responsible in the sense, let's say they didn't patch appropriately, and now you have them sort of fixing the mistake, obviously they have a disincentive or a different incentive in the investigation, because they're going to be biased, because if they want to cover their tracks and reasonably so, but also they're not qualified, they're not experienced in it. And so it's a disservice to you if you have somebody unqualified conducting the investigation, because you're not going to have it done the most efficient manner. You're not going to have the benefit of all the insight that these companies, that these vendors that we work with on a regular basis, that do thousands of these, they're very familiar with the threat actors. They're very familiar with their means of getting in and what they like to do. And so you deprive yourself of that information. And then also on the legal side, right? as attorneys, not only do we know the regulatory and legal notification obligation things, but we're on all these calls too. And so we have some insight and experience in terms of how to strategize, whether it's with the threat actor or with customers, communicating with customers about the messaging and things of that nature. And so if you have the cyber insurance, not only are you going to defray costs, but you're also going to have yourself, you're going to arm yourself with experts that are really designed to sort of take the load off. We're going to manage all this. You focus on other things. And so I think that is that aligning you with experts is often an overlooked aspect, I think, of why you should have cyber insurance. And so, you know, I just had an incident the other day where the company was like, yeah, we're not going to report this to insurance. We have backups. We're just going to pull our backups and sort of reformat and go from there. And I'm trying to tell them that's like the worst thing you could possibly do, because you don't know how this incident happened. You don't know what's, you know, you don't know if it's going to happen again. And how are you going to report? You may have reporting obligations, but you're not going to know it. So you're taking a real shortcut. And now if this happens again to them, well, that's not a good, I wouldn't want to be in that, you know, answering questions if I'm the CEO as to, you know, this is your second incident, what'd you do in response to the first incident? And their answer is nothing. And, oh, you had insurance. Why didn't you call insurance? Cause I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want my premium to go up. So I think that's definitely an area that I think is overlooked.
Yeah. I think it's, it is interesting how people, I think they get used to a different type of insurance. And so in their minds, the first thing they're thinking of is not, you know, the types of claim service or the different types of service providers that you can be connected to, who are, I think are encouraged to do things in a sensible way. You know, I think it's, you get sort of incident response vendors in other markets, you know, that's the only time you ever deal with that vendor. Whereas I think there's a relationship between the insurance companies, the law firms, technical firms, you know, in this industry that there's a credibility and there's a sort of a social standard to kind of do things in the right way and do right by clients.
I absolutely agree with that. I find that, you know, typically when you talk about insurance, it's always, God, the insurance is going to nickel and dime me and they're going to find every single way they can to say this isn't covered, and or they're going to limit the recovery amount. And, you know, cyber insurance, in my experience, is the exact opposite, where, you know, most calls it's, hey, this is definitely a covered event. You know, this is going to be, you know, starting after you've met your deductible, all of the attorney's fees are covered, all of the forensic fees are covered. So I definitely find it to be a very more of a helpful approach, right? The carrier in this process is really on your side, and the carriers, hey, I'm gonna set you up with these vendors. I'm gonna set you up with these attorneys. We vetted these attorneys. We vetted these forensic vendors. We trust them. We know what they're doing. And you really, hey, it's all sort of served to you on a platter of, hey, just listen to them, and we got you covered. And I think for the law firms and for the forensic vendors, they obviously have, you know, they have their obligations to the insured in terms of providing, you know, the utmost service and everything like that. But there's a checks and balances in place as well, where, hey, we know as a law firm, if we do an inefficient job or a bad job, guess what? There's somebody, the insurance company can pick somebody else next time. Mm-hmm. And same with the forensic vendor. Hey, if the insurance company or the law firm that picked us doesn't like the work that we do, there's somebody else that can do this too. And so I think that checks and balances also helps create that sort of maximize that efficiency, which ultimately helps the insured. And so I think the system is, you know, I think that seems to be a sort of unintended consequence of how the system has been set up, but I think a good consequence. And it's definitely a pleasant, you know, departure from the normal sort of feeling that you get with insurance, which is they're not there to help you. They're there to protect their wallets. I get the totally different sense with cyber. So,
yeah. And I think there's actually, you know, and there's a lot of conversations I've had on this, but I think there's really good alignment between the insurers and the insured in the vast majority of cases when it comes to a cyber incident.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I guess just talking a bit, you know, about incident response process, you know, maybe I could just ask a really general question or a really direct question, which is, what's your approach to doing IR?
Sure. I think my approach is really, I I take the concept of, look, these notification statutes are drafted in the eye of what's beneficial to the individual, right? Does the individual require notification? And there's obviously reasons why an individual wants to be notified of you know, unauthorized acquisition or access of their personal information. But as incident response counsel, I am representing a company. I'm not representing the individual. And so my focus can't be on what's best for the individual. My focus has to be on what's best for the company. And sometimes notifying is not what's best for the company. There can be a bevy of reasons why notification is going to cause more harm than good for the company. And so I take the approach of, I'm going to focus on what's in the best interest of the company. I'm obviously not going to run afoul of laws and tell the company, you know, this is absolutely, the law requires you to do X, but I'm going to tell you to do the exact opposite, because I don't think, you know, that's too much risk to put the company in. And so that's not going to achieve what's best for the company. But I definitely think there's more to an approach of, oh, you know, here's personal information that's been exfiltrated. We must notify. There's, you know, there's avenues in the law, whether, you know, some states have risk of harm analysis that you can adopt that basically says, all right, yes, is this defined? Is this considered a breach under the law? Yes, it is. But even though it's a breach, do we have to report it to the individual? And, you know, the states vary on what the reasoning is and how you can achieve or meet that standard. But a lot of times, I think that's an overlooked aspect of the incident response process, where you're focused solely on, oh, the consumer needs to know that their, you know, medical record number was, you know, from 2013 is on the dark web. And I don't necessarily agree with that, right? I think from a company standpoint, is that really what these statutes are intended to do? And is that really a good use of your resources from a business standpoint to go out and notify in a situation that, you know, frankly, doesn't warrant notification? And so I really try to focus on the company, what's best for the company. And that, you know, that's a balancing of legal risk. It's a balancing of business risk with their customers, vendors. Sometimes reporting is going to destroy the company, because if you know, they have a Fortune 50 customer of theirs, and that they find out, that's going to destroy their agreement with that customer. And without that agreement, that business relationship, the company is, you know, won't survive. And so in a situation like that, notification is really sort of the last thing that we want to do. So my approach is really a practical approach focused on the organization. But at the same time, I'm balancing risks. And certainly I'm not putting the organization in a situation where they're going to be hit with a hefty lawsuit and a winnable lawsuit from the plaintiff side, because that's not going to do the business very well. And it's also going to increase their claims. And so that's not going to do me any favors with the insurance company either. So I have to balance those things out, but that's really what I try to do in my response process.
Okay. Yeah, it seems like you're focused on being very pragmatic and very focused on, you know, minimizing the harm to the businesses you're helping.
That's the approach that I try to take. And I think, you know, I think I always like to look at it from, I'm the organization, what's going to be best for me from the organizational standpoint. And lots of times I'll be able to come up with a way where, you know, in those contexts, lots of times the organization will say, you know, I want to do the right thing, right? The proverbial right thing. I want to be, you know, I have a moral obligation to let my employees know, and just things of that nature. And I understand those sentiments, right? Because there's, you know, companies like to use transparency as a word of how they approach things. And so a lot of times we'll come up with compromises in terms of, we'll do sort of a non-legal notification to the employees, let's say, that says, okay, you know, here we had an incident, but, you know, for whatever reason, we don't need to report the incident, but, you know, we're giving you some complimentary credit monitoring, just, you know, as sort of a goodwill type of gesture, where we're able to balance able to balance legal obligations, business obligations, and then the sort of opposed views of doing what's quote unquote transparent and right versus what's right for the business. And so I take all that into consideration, but definitely I want to be very practical and give the organization all the options available. And obviously it's their decision ultimately, but my job is to let them know, these are the options, these are the risks, this is what I recommend, but obviously I'm going to follow what the organization wants at the end of the day.
So, you know, how do you measure that? What kind of metrics or KPIs are the most important to you?
When we're talking about an incident response in terms of whether we want to notify and things of that nature, I look often at the industry. I look often at the size of the population. So if we're talking about, you know, 100,000 potential individuals at play, then I'm going to take a less risky approach, because that 100,000 number is going to, you know, numbers lead to class action suits, right? So if we have a big population, regardless of the type of information that's out there, if we don't notify or we do notify, that number is going to come into play in terms of that analysis, right? So sometimes if there's like five people, let's say, it's really innocuous data, but the company has a very sort of approach of we want to do the right thing and notify and let our customers know. I would, you know, let's notify in that situation because it's five people. The risk is very low. The cost is very low. The risk of getting, you know, sued for notifying is very low. It's a sort of a low cost type of endeavor. And that might create some goodwill, right? Those five customers will say, hey, you know what? I got this letter. This company is very, you know, transparent, and they've told me what happened. They're apologetic. They told me what they're going to do. That might create some goodwill for the company. Conversely, there's times where, you know, I've had situations where I've dealt with sort of medical and like abuse shelter notification organizations that where they had a gray area whether to notify. And so I look into, okay, what's the impact on the individual receiving the notification? So in some situations, if you're like a victim of domestic abuse, obviously, you know, you go to those abuse shelters, and those are very confidential for obvious reasons. And so if I was a victim of abuse and I got a letter from the abuse shelter saying, hey, we had a data security incident, and that might trigger me to go back to the state I was in when I was abused. I may still be in that state of abuse. My abuser may get that information in the mail before I do, and say, and that creates issues. Well, you know, why are you, you know, telling people that I've abused you type of situation. And so that's a different area where we have to be very cognizant of, as the organization, right? My job is to protect the victims of domestic abuse. If I'm notifying them, I'm not carrying out that obligation. And so the metrics are going to vary based on the situation, but, you know, it's going to be based on the industry, the sort of the state of the recipients, right? And when I say state of the recipients, if we're domestic abuse victims, that's going to really, really be an important consideration. If we're talking about, you know, attorneys receiving the letters, that's going to be an important consideration because, you know, especially in California, you know, there's attorneys can be very litigious and say, well, you know, you guys messed up my personal information, I'm going to go ahead and sue you type of thing. So you have to balance that, as well as just the potential size of the notification pool, because the larger the notification pool is, I think the greater likelihood that you'll get a class action suit. So those are the types of things that you look for. But one of the nice things about incident response is sort of, you know, while there's lots of certainty and uniformity in the process, there's always variances that make it so exciting and fun in terms of the strategy that goes into, okay, well, in this situation, what should we do? In that situation, what should we do? And I think the benefit of having done so many of these incidents and responses to them, you can take from the experience of, well, in this situation, we did this, so I think it'll work here. Or while that worked in the prior situation, I think it's a little bit different here because of XYZ. And so you can use your experience and build upon to make you a better advisor for your clients.
Okay. Some interesting points there. I hadn't really considered some of those, especially around, you know, different states and different behaviors of law firms there. So I guess shifting gears a bit, you know, let's say you have 10 of your peers in a room. What kind of question would you ask them?
I would ask probably a number of questions. So the first I would ask them is, first, I guess, how did I become a peer of yours? Because I don't, you know, I think everybody is far better than me. And so I would apologize that somebody has placed us in a room together, because they are certainly far above me than I am. But aside from that, I would say, look, what can I do as an attorney to be better? I'm hopeful that they would know something about me, seen my approach. I assume some of those people would be people that have, you know, hired me or worked with me in the past and say, hey, I think I'm, you know, what do you think is an area of as an advocate in this incident response space that I can do better? And so I would want to learn, I would want to ask that question to see what I can do better. I don't want to be selfish and just say, hey, what, you know, make this all about me. So I would ask them what I can do as an individual to help support them and what, you know, what I can do to help them, whether it's they need an introduction with somebody, they want to, you know, run an idea off me, they have a legal question, they're, you know, they're trying to decide whether to notify, hey, they want to, you know, run a scenario by me, that sort of thing. Let them know that I'm always there to offer any type of advice or, you know, support that I can, because I like to think that in this industry, we're all here to really help one another. Mm-hmm. Obviously our goal is always to help the victim of the incident or the, you know, the insured, but I think it goes above that and beyond that, where we want to sort of help each other and you know, just be good, sort of good people and help each other. So I would definitely ask, you know, what I can do to help you. And then I think the other question I would ask is, from a motivation standpoint, and it's more of a curiosity thing than anything else, what motivates them? Like, what's their sort of end goal in what they're trying to do, right? Because I think everybody has different reasons for why they are doing certain things, and why, you know, what's their motivation? Do they want to be the head of an organization? Do they want to mentor individuals? What's motivating them? Because I just find that to be just curious in terms of what drives people. And that'd be more just to satisfy intellectual curiosity than anything else.
Okay. Interesting. Well, I think, I like your point about, you know, sort of the tight-knit nature and the supportive nature of the industry. I think it is a great point. I really have always enjoyed it.
Yeah. You know, the last 6 weeks or so, since I started at Trout and Pepper, I've been reaching out to a lot of people that I've worked with in the past, made lots, you know, people have always been very generous with their time to, you know, take the time to speak with me, give mm-hmm. me the opportunity to talk about Trout and Pepper and what we're trying to do. If, you know, always ask me, hey, are there companies you're trying to, you know, make introductions or reach out to, I can make introductions. I can put you in touch with people. It's been extremely, extremely supportive and what a pleasant surprise, right? To, you know, typically in the law firm environment, it can be a situation where, you know, the person next to you that, you know, appears to be your friend and your supporter is the first one to, you know, put a knife in your back. And unfortunately I've, you know, experienced things like that. Yeah. And so in this realm, it's been just the opposite and really have been overwhelmed by the amount of support that people have given me and the positive, hey, you know, good luck in this new endeavor. And I think a lot of that is a lot of these individuals have been in sort of the new person in the industry as well. There's lots of new companies and it's real, you know, it's this organ, this industry has been around for a while, but it's still relatively new. And I think that, I think people have often been sort of the new person and they know what it feels like. And so I think there's a lot of empathy with that. But, you know, I will happily take it, whatever the reason. It's been very nice.
I guess that ties a bit into maybe, some challenges for you. You know, what would you say, you know, your team or company's biggest challenges right now?
Our biggest challenge is really sort of getting our foot in the insurance door. And I think, you know, there's, I don't know if it's 5, 6, 7, I'm certainly not trying to leave anybody off the list, but there's a half a dozen or a dozen law firms that are sort of well-known in the industry that do incident response work with the insurance companies, and they do it quite well, right? And I've worked at a couple of those firms. And so I think the hard part is to say, hey, I'm kind of like those firms because I've worked at those firms. Not all of them, of course, but some of them, I know what they do. And saying, give us a chance, right? And it's not like Trout and Pepper itself is a new firm, right? It's been around for, you know, gosh knows how many decades, but it's relatively new in this space. And so I certainly understand from the carrier standpoint of taking the risk, hey, why am I going to go to Troutman Pepper when I know these other firms have done it and can do it well, giving us a chance. That's sort of been the hardest part of, hey, just because these other firms do it, doesn't mean that we can't also do it. Doesn't mean there isn't, you know, we can't do it a little bit differently. And finding a way to sort of discern, all right, I'm going to go to firm A for these types of matters. I'm going to go to firm B for these types of matters. I'm going to go to Troutman Pepper for these types of matters. Because we don't have, you know, we're not inundated with matters right now. It's hard for us to say, hey, you know, we are, you know, if you have a matter in this industry with this size, come to us, because we've done, you know, here's a list of successful outcomes we've had there. So that's sort of the hard part of getting our foot in the door. And it's sort of that catch 22 of, you know, I need experience to have a job, but I can't get a job without experience type of thing, where I want to be able to show you all of the good things I can do. But if you're not going to give me a chance to do that, I can't show that to you. But, you know, that's to be expected. I understand. And so one of the tasks that I've, or challenges and also, I guess, tasks I've undertaken is really trying to explain to the decision makers, look, I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel here, right? It's a good process in place, and it's obviously been very effective. I'm just somebody new here, and I have, you know, here's my approach. Here's how I like to do things. Here's how I like to, you know, train people on how to do this. Give us a chance. I'm very confident that if you give us a chance, that we'll, you know, we'll meet or exceed your expectations, and then mm-hmm. to start building that process out from there.
Yeah. I think we're, you know, some very similar challenges. You know, starting a new practice or starting a new firm, certainly that I can resonate with. So what are some of the things you're doing? You know, you've kind of started to talk a bit about it, but what are you doing maybe in terms of marketing, getting better known? What are some stuff that's going, some things that are going on with you?
Yeah, I've been, so I guess much to my chagrin, when I first started, they blasted a big press release with my picture, and they sent it to all my contacts, and they kept asking, you know, give me a list of your contacts, and I kept trying to ignore that email, because the last thing I wanted to do was send a big, you know, picture of me and hey, I'm at this new firm. But I've had a lot of great support from Troutman Pepper on their marketing side and business development side that has really helped me. But certainly getting my name out there, letting people know that I am now at Troutman Pepper, and then, you know, using that as a springboard, going back to carriers that I've worked with in the past and developed good relationships with, letting them know, hey, I'm here, love the opportunity to work with you in the future. You know, give me a chance to explain what we're trying to do here. And I've gotten, you know, pretty favorable reception to that, of just people listening to what we're trying to do, listening to our pitch, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I use that sort of, you know, obviously I want to explain what we're trying to do, because I want to generate business, of course, but also I use that as a springboard with, you know, people that I trust. Give me some feedback. Is my pitch, does my pitch resonate? What resonated, what didn't resonate. And so to modify that, as I go on, I was talking with somebody in the industry that I really respect and trust. And I was talking about sort of Troutman taking a very sort of comprehensive approach to privacy, sort of talking about those three pillars we talked about at the outset of compliance, incident response, and regulation, and sort of combining those three. And he said, that sounds great, but it also sounds very expensive. And so from a carrier standpoint, that's, you know, I said, all right, I will never, aside from this explanation here, I said, I will never use that phrase again, because the last thing we're trying to do is create a situation where the costs are, you know, exorbitantly high, right? We're just trying to do the same thing, same cost, but with a little bit of a difference that I think is going to create a better outcome at the end of the day, both for the insured and also for the insurance carrier. And so I've been really just trying to hit my message home to various people. And I've gone to conferences, you know, Net Diligence. I was just at Cyber Plus this week, and just talking with people, meeting with people, you know, just getting to know people. I think my approach to this is maybe too simple, where I just like to know the people that I'm working with. And so I really like to have conversations and really understand sort of what motivates them, how they like to operate, what their philosophies are on things, and use that as sort of the springboard to develop a relationship first. And then if that relationship lends itself to business, fantastic. But I don't like to come in and, you know, as sort of the traveling salesman and, you know, open up my briefcase and, you know, here are the pitch materials, here are our prices, you know, do we have a sale kind of deal? I don't know if that's effective, but I'm sure it is for some people. But for me, it's certainly, I don't think I can pull that off. So it's going to be more of a longer road of just getting people, letting people know, you know, I think the benefit I have is some people know the type of work that I do. And I think most of those people are pleased with the type of work that I do. So that certainly does help, but it's really just been about talking to people, letting them know what I can do, reminding them what I can do, and then also letting them know what Troutman & Pepper can do in this field, because, you know, they're relatively new here.
As a larger firm, but it's new to insurance.
Correct.
Broader is what I meant to say. So I guess, you know, just, I guess there's a lot going on in the news. What's something that, you know, specific to cyber that you find really interesting right now?
I find a lot of the focus on, you know, I think a lot of this started with the Colonial Pipeline situation of last year, where there seems to be obviously an emphasis now on cybersecurity related regulations or laws. And they usually tend to be more industry specific, whether it's financial or, and we're talking about infrastructural type of situations. And I know there was some recent proposals from Biden. We're talking about sort of top secret type of information and having cybersecurity protocols to protect that information. So I think the two things that surprised me the most was on that top secret cybersecurity protocol that wasn't in place before, right? Because some of the protocols about like having multi-factor authentication, I was surprised to see something as simple as that to be in the protocol, like, because we're talking about our very, you know, top secret information. So
yeah.
I think part of the shock is seem to be kind of behind when it comes to that. But I don't think that's too much of a surprise. Go ahead. I don't cut you off.
I used to work in defense, so I have a lot of opinions on that, but yeah, I would say that the simple answer is probably that there was a heavy reliance on other types of security rather than the tech. You know, you're often isolated from networks and things like that. Now that's definitely, changed over time, and I'm probably out of date, but.
No, yeah. It makes perfect sense. And then the other aspect has been, I think on those cybersecurity, I'll just call them regulations for lack of a better term, has been the focus on timing of notification. And that was obviously when GDPR was coming out, there was that sort of 72-hour timeframe. We're talking about a data breach. That generated a lot of buzz as well, because people like 72 hours, that's not enough time. And I'm not going to talk about GDPR here, but I think the focus on notification and timely notification, I think is sort of a double-edged sword here, right? I certainly understand if an incident occurred and people are impacted by that incident, they want to know that, hey, there's an incident and somebody's trying to, you know, we're trying to work on finding out this incident, but I think finding out information about the incident. But I think putting those sort of arbitrary timelines is really a disservice, because I've dealt with plenty of companies where they had contractual obligations, where if there was an incident, they had to notify one of their customers about the incident within, let's say, whatever, 48 hours, 72 hours, whatever the case may be. And you go and you notify them, and their first question is, okay, well, how did the incident happen? And your answer is, I don't know. It's under investigation. Well, what data of ours was impacted? I don't know. It's under investigation. And I've been told that, I was on one of those calls and the customer was like, well, why, telling the impacted entity, why did you hire this law firm? They don't know anything. They haven't done anything. It's been 48 hours. They've gotten nothing done. And so that's, you know, obviously someone that doesn't understand the timing of the process, where usually in 48 hours, you're not going to know the whole story of how the threat actor got in and what the threat actor took. You could in some situations, but that's more rare. And so I think that's a reflection of people that are making these regulations aren't really sort of in the thick of things. And I understand the sort of the impetus behind that. But from a practical standpoint, that's a waste of our time. If we're on a call with a customer trying to answer questions, that's time that could be used better trying to stop the incident, remediate and restore and conduct the forensic investigation. All those types of conversations tend to do is frustrate the customer and make the customer think that the company that's been hit doesn't know what they're doing and that they're incompetent. Yeah. And so not only now do you have to go through that sort of arbitrary, non-legal, contractual notification, but now you also have to sort of repair that the damage that was caused by that call where you sound completely incompetent because you don't have answers to questions that you're expecting. So it sounds like, well, you hired this law firm and this forensic firm and they don't know anything. And so it's like, why did you hire them for? And so I think the focus there is off in terms of notify. I think the focus obviously should be on prevention, but prevention is, you make a one misstep. If you've done 10,000 good things, you do one misstep, they're in. So I know prevention is somewhat illusory, but the focus there should be, not so much on notification, because I just think it sort of misses what the whole point of notification is. Mm-hmm. The point of notification is to let people know there's a potential that their information can impact them negatively. It's not meant to be, something more than that, at least in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, gotcha. So I guess just kind of maybe a couple closing questions. It's sure. been an enjoyable show so far.
I've had lots of fun. Thank you very much for this.
I wanted to ask you, how did you end up getting into sort of the legal industry and how'd you end up working with insurers?
So I got into the legal industry really by, what's the right way to phrase it? As growing up, I was told there are three potential jobs for any person. One is a doctor, lawyer, or engineer. And I don't say that jokingly. Those are the three choices that my father said you have. My father, of course, is an engineer, and my father's math skills far, exceed mine. And so I immediately said, I cannot be an engineer. So I was, all right, well, I'll be a doctor. My uncle's a doctor. So I'll be a doctor too, not realizing how difficult it is to actually become a doctor. And so I was a microbiology and molecular genetics major in my undergrad. And I took the MCAT twice, didn't score high enough to really get me very competitive at medical schools. And so I applied to medical schools, didn't get in. I think I was waitlisted on one or two, and I was pretty distraught and sort of disillusioned with, I spent all this time trying to be a doctor. What am I going to do? And I was walking on campus at UCLA, and there was a Kaplan, which is like a test prep place here. And they said, take a mock LSAT for free. And so I said, all right, I did. And I scored pretty well on the mock LSAT. And I said, well, this medical school stuff has been a real, real struggle. I've been working really, really hard and doing, working twice as hard as my peers, but doing half as well. And so that was really the first time I ever did well on something without really, preparing. And so I thought, maybe this is something to pursue. And so So I went ahead and pursued that. And my goal was always to be, an actor, which I know sounds foolish given my lack of acting skills and my lack of trying to be an actor or anything like that. But I figure this incident response is hopefully what I've been meant to do. And so that's sort of how I got into legal. And then once I started out as a litigator, just, sort of me sort of rubbing people the wrong way, probably, or people, jumping from firm to firm and just trying to find what sort of the right fit for me. And I think, with the incident response, been able to find that's been really a very enjoyable aspect of my career and one that I hope I can, bring to Troutman Pepper and give those attorneys there that opportunity to really do the incident response work. I think it's a really rewarding area of the law where you're really able to have an immediate impact on the insured. And a lot of times you'll get an insured, they're distraught, they don't know what to do, their systems are down, they feel that they're at fault. and they just don't know where to go, what to do. And so to be able to sort of really guide them through that process, and you can sort of on those calls, you know, day one, they're distraught. Day two, they're a little bit better. You know, days three and four, you can make some jokes and they're smiling and they sort of see the light at the end of the tunnel. And then at the end of that process where they're very, you know, appreciative and thankful of, hey, you know, you got us through this type of thing. That really makes me feel, you know, I'm adding value to something and to somebody. And so to me, that's really been such a rewarding aspect that I, you know, wasn't really expecting. But it's a feeling that I just crave and I really want to sort of emulate. And so that's what really drives me in this incident response world.
Okay. Well, great. So recommendations for next podcast guest, who do you think we should talk to?
So yeah, that's a great question. I would love, I don't know if this will make for a compelling guest, but I think it will, which is, what does the FBI do when you have like a wire fraud transfer issue? Because there's always, you know, like that 72-hour window where the FBI can do something and claw the money back when it goes to a threat actor. And I would love to know what that process is, in part because I'm very curious, but also in part, that's in the incident response process, that's an aspect that often we don't really address. And a lot of times it's because people don't come to us until it's been weeks until that wire fraud transfer happened, because they don't know about it necessarily, or they've called their bank and they've gotten the runaround from their bank for a week and then they decided to call us. So I've had some success, you know, and I've just emailed some contacts with the FBI that they sort of handle that aspect, but I've never gotten into the sort of ins and outs of what they look for, what they do, and how customers or organizations, what if there's anything they can do on the forefront or before that kind of happens to sort of stop that from happening or put them in a better position if that does happen. So to me, that's always a fascinating area.
Yeah, it's interesting. Along those lines. That's great. Thanks for the recommendation. Well, that concludes, you know, everything I had to chat about. You know, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show, and you know, we'll look forward to chatting with you again soon.
Well, thank you so much, Anthony. I really, really appreciate this opportunity. Always a pleasure to talk with you. And I know we have a lot in common in terms of trying to, you know, start up our respective practices here. And so it's really been a delight. Like I said at the beginning, I really thought it was your error that you picked me, but I'm glad that you did. And I really had a lot of fun. And hopefully we can do this again in the future. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.